good afternoon, and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the third weekend of November 2025. We're just a little over a month away from the winter solstice, and accordingly, we are very much in the dark time of the year, with sunset and darkness ensuing late in the afternoon these days. If you are getting a chance to get out and see what's around, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can visit my site, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded with Carrie Sagal and Brooke Schaefer. This is the Sitka Nature side of the Library Show, Sitka Nature Show, a crossover that we try to do each year. I was a guest on the Library Show this week and was grateful to have Carrie and Brooke share with me. We'll go ahead and join the conversation with Carrie talking about a book that she brought in to share.
For a book club, I'm reading the book Circe, which is the story of daughter of Helios, the sun god, who's exiled to an island where she kind of comes into her own. She can't leave unless she's given permission, but it's an island filled with plants. And actually, Brooke, I'm going to give you the honor to say that I thought of you when I read this passage.
Whoa.
I stepped into those woods and my life began. I learned to braid my hair back so it would not catch on every twig and how to tie my skirts at the knee to keep the burrs off. I learned to recognize the different blooming vines and gaudy roses, to spot the shining dragonflies and coiling snakes. I climbed the peaks where the cypresses speared back black into the sky, then clambered down to the orchards and vineyards where purple grapes grew thick as coral. And I'd keep reading, but it's a long paragraph. And I just think of you out adventuring and seeing the things and learning the things and finding the trails and knowing the terrain.
So I feel very honored. That's very nice.
She kind of comes into her own on this island and becomes, I forget what the term is, but basically a pharmacist of sorts with plants. And I started underlining. I don't normally mark a book, but I started underlining all the plants that were in the book. And there are things that you would expect, like laurel and oak and olive and pomegranate. But then they mention this plant called Molly. And I thought, okay, I've got to look that one up. I've never heard of it. Plus, it's M-O-L-Y, weird, you know, like a weird sort of word. It's interesting because Molly is not exactly known what Molly is. I read an article, a scientific article, about what Molly might be, and they carefully laid out that, of course, the story of the Odyssey is a mixture of very fantastical things, and you could dismiss everything as fantastical, but also there's these clear descriptions of how ships were built, how military men arranged themselves, what they wore. So there's details of actual life, and there is a chance that Molly is a real plant. So there's a whole group of people who theorize on what Molly is. And one of the first theories was it was this plant called, it's described in the Odyssey as having white petals and a black root. And the one author kind of shares, first of all, that back in the day, they didn't have the same concept of color. Mm-hmm. So what is a black root? Because there is a plant called snowdrop. Let's see if I can pull up.
We have that here, Galanthus.
Yes, yeah. Galanthus. Uh-huh. Yeah. Galanthus that has more of a papery bulb, you know, but as back in the day, they may have called that black because they didn't have the full range of color expressions that we have. But what was interesting about it is Circe in this novel is using it as an antidote. She's transformed two people into one, into a horrible monster, and she's hoping she can transform them back. And I think she attempts to use Molly to do that. And one of the interesting thing about the Galanthus is it contains a chemical called galanthamine. And if you've taken a drug or you've had an illness that interrupts the neurons of your brain and prevents proper firing, if you take galanthamine, it can kind of cure it. It was first noticed by some Russian dude in the Urals who saw that local people were using the snowdrops to treat children who'd had polio and treat some aspects of their paralysis. So But then a whole other paper came out that said, no, it's not Galanthus, and kind of laid out their argument about why they think it's something called... I'll have to look here.
That's so cool, though, because also, like, reversing, you could say that someone having, like, their neural pathways affected could turn them monstrous, right?
Yes.
And so that kind of aligns with this...
The second scientific paper I wrote basically is saying that Circe doesn't actually transform men into pigs, that the men have taken something she's given them, and it could have been poppy, henbane, mandrake, something she's given them, and they're hallucinating, believing they're pigs. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Homer then, or the... who is it? Hermes. When Odysseus is coming to her island, gives him... Molly.
To give to Circe.
To make sure that his men are transformed.
Yeah.
That he can cure his men and block the effects of her poisons that she uses to transform the men into pigs. But it's just interesting when a story leads to gobs of people in science investigating what could this Molly be?
It's interesting. So this is, just to be clear, so this is Circe, which is a modern author writing.
Yes, a modern author retelling the story from Circe's point of view.
I see. Okay. And so, yeah, I mean, what you're sharing there reminds me, we're recording this the week after Whale Fest. Whale Fest was last week, and I was there. The last speaker on Sunday was David Kanosh, local elder storyteller. And, you know, his talk was about, and this is actually something we talked about on a prior library show because I had read a book called Memory Craft. Mm-hmm. And so we were talking about that. And he actually, that author, Lynn Kelly, has a new book out that David, wrote the foreword for. Mm-hmm. And when he heard about Memory Craft, David had basically learned a lot of these techniques from his grandparents, hearing stories from them. And, you know, he was talking about the way in which, and this is something that author has studied, you know, around the world, the way in which cultural knowledge is encoded in stories. And you need to remember them over generations and not, like, have them messed up in the retelling. And one of the ways that you do that is to put really crazy, you know, sex, drugs, violence, all the things that modern television, you know, attracts us with, like those are very traditional ways of getting people's attention. And so in these stories, and often that these stories would have multiple versions, they'd have the child's version, and then as people move through. And so when anthropologists were coming, they would get the child's version. And they're like, oh, these are such simple stories. But when you actually get the full complex version, they can last for hours or days, you know, the telling. And there's an immense amount of, like, knowledge encoded in those. So when you're speaking about, this probably was true of the Greek epics as well, you know. And it's like, what are these things referring to? We've lost that cultural knowledge.
The second paper does address that in relation to this question of what is Molly. It said that it's a long oral tradition that conflated all sorts of stories. And then their premise was, this is not one plant, although sea daffodils kind of struck them as something that had those same properties, but what they called an ethnobotanical complex. So we're mistaken in thinking that they saw plants in the same way we did, and like this plant has this name, that they might have seen a plant that had this quality of reversing damage, reversing neural blockage, and it might have been similar in looking to something maybe related to it, so they would kind of put them all together, and maybe they called many plants by the name of Molly. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, even in modern times, we're still refining what we mean by species based on genetics and those sorts of things. So it is an interesting challenge, I guess, for those of us who are interested in natural history, and just tell me the name. And at some level, it kind of doesn't matter. You know, it's whatever you want to call it. It's like you can build a relationship with a species or an individual, if you like, the tree that you always walk by and, you know, say hello to for whatever reason, or just notice. It doesn't really matter. You can call him Bob if you want, or Spruce. It's nice to have a name as a placeholder. And if you want to communicate with other people, then it becomes important to have common shared names. There's purposes for different names, but, you know, I'm kind of pragmatic about, well, you know, it depends on what your purposes are. And if it's just purely about your own sort of awareness and cultivating that in the world in which you live, then, yeah, call it whatever you want. I mean, we give our pets individual names, right? We don't just, well, some of us just call them Cat, I suppose, but They have individual names because we relate to them as individuals.
I never gave my cat a proper name.
Oh, was it always just Cat?
I know I had a lot of endearments for it, but it did not have a name in my mind because I always thought of it, it's a cat. Like, how do I know what its name is? It might know its name, but I don't know its name. So, yeah, I would call it Pumpkin Bud and Sweetie and Honey Bug, but it didn't really have a name except at the vet's.
Well, that's interesting. I was just listening to a podcast, Telepathy Tapes podcast, and they're speaking with animal communicator, and it was a cat. There was a vet that was very skeptical of her ability, and it remains so apparently, but wanted to test because she did seem to be able to come in and say what was wrong with an animal, because she would basically communicate with the animal and the animal would tell her, and the vet wanted to test her on her own animals because she knows her own animals. And so initially she asked her about these dogs, and then and the dog, you know, is all very standard stuff, and so not surprising and not really anything that you'd be like, oh, this person is doing something special. But then the vet asked her about a cat that had been brought in, had been abandoned, basically, its owners had left, and it was just like in this closet, and she asked about the cat and then asked the cat's name, and the cat didn't have a name, and so she asked it what it wanted to be called. And I can't remember what the two names were, but it turned out the names that the cat told the animal communicator, who then relayed it to the vet, were the name of her daughter and I think the name of her mother. And so people that were very meaningful in that woman's life, and it was like the cat was saying, I just want to be called something that's going to make me get some attention paid to it, because it was like totally freaked out. There's dogs around. It's getting no attention and no love whatsoever. And so it was like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe cats have a name that they want to be called, or maybe they don't, but it was just interesting. Well, we haven't heard any stories from you yet, Brooke, but...
Well, I didn't bring any books.
Well, yeah, you didn't have to bring books. Okay. I don't think we've talked about books on this show before. I mean, we have on this show generally.
Well, I have to say, when this was again proposed, I panicked.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, I haven't been out in nature. What do I know? What have I done? What will I talk about?
Yeah.
And you can be an amateur and an armchair person who's interested in nature and the world. And that's what I'm doing right now maybe something in my home, reading something.
Well, there's so many ways to know nature. I think that you just gave us a great example of all the reading you did about these plants and learning about them. And yeah, but I had a similar experience too, where I just happened to have not been able to get outside as much this year in the ways that I normally do. So I felt like, I'm not sure if I have like any... What am I going to talk about? But then I did reflect on the fact that, like, you, Matt, are a big proponent of kind of, I guess, what we were just chatting about, which is just like being, you don't have to go do something dramatic or big or far away to really be observant and curious and aware of what's around you. And like, you've had projects, I think, Matt, where you observe in your own yard, you know, and like, that's such a rich area. I definitely love to watch the things change in my own yard. And so that made me think of a new thing that I have taken on this year that I could do real close to home and I could do on a regular basis. So it allowed me to sort of look at the earth, our neighborhoods, in a slightly different way, which is swimming in the ocean.
Oh.
And which has been such a fun adventure for its own little thing. But what has been fun to think about in the context of coming to chat with you is like, what did I notice over, I started in January of 2025 this year. So I've been doing it through, and now it's November. So I've been having the experience of these places going into the water on a regular basis and seeing how things change and what else is there and what else shows up, and having a few, you know, things that kind of bubble to the surface more or feel a little more exciting than other things. And that felt related to like the way you kind of go through your experience with nature, Matt, which is like just being open and aware of wherever you are. So that was what I wanted to talk about today. And I had one experience that I...
Well, can I ask you a couple questions? Just like the logistics of it. So are you going like once a week, every day, or...
My ideal would be going 3 times a week, but I don't. Once a week, I'm down to once a week right now. I also haven't yet gone alone.
Okay. And so, is this literally swimming or soaking or?
Swimming, yeah. Swimming either a kilometer mile or something.
That's not joking around amount of swimming.
It's like swimming laps, I guess, but in the ocean.
Right.
Yeah.
So are you doing an out and back or swimming circles or?
An out and back.
Yeah.
I have 2 places that I swim, and that has to do with the change in the seasons. The Sage Beach is where I put in for one of the swims, but when the fish are dying and also during the herring spawn, that's not a good place to, that's not a place you want to put in. And so there's another spot that's really nice at the north part of Halibut Point Rec, and you can swim towards that island with a shack on it. And that is, the fish aren't quite congregated in death up on the beach there. You can get out and not be in the death quite as much during that time of year. So, and it's also really lovely out there. So that's a fun place to go if there's a little bit more time. Sage Beach is right downtown, which is where I live. So that's a quick one. But yeah, that's what I'm doing.
And then it's a wetsuit.
Exactly. I just went back to my heavy duty wetsuit.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cause I mean, you didn't give yourself the sort of gentle on ramp of like August maximum water temperatures. You're like, oh, let's do it in January when they're almost the coldest.
Yeah. Well, just there was a woman in town who does it, and she was like, sure, I'll go with you. And she was ready to start in January. And so I wore my thickest wetsuit. And then I did not write down when I moved to a 0.5 milliliter with no hood. But I just moved back to my thick wetsuit, I think 2-3 weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
And had you been, I mean, did you from the beginning do that like 1K swim or?
Attempted. First time I didn't make it to that.
Yeah. That's a long swim. Seems like to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I swam.
Oh man. It felt so far like in terms of like, that's crazy. We're going to go, where are we going to make it? But then once you do it, it's not that it's very.
So what attention do you pay to tides in deciding when to swim?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, the dippers, I feel like, pay a little bit more attention to tides because there are places that it's hard to get into the water without a nice sandy beach. Like there are rocks hidden under the water and you'll fall over them and everything. So, but for swimming laps, I mean, the entrance isn't quite as important, I guess. I think I tend to like a higher tide myself, but I'll just pay attention to like if it's an incoming or an outgoing, knowing when I'm going to be fighting the tide or if it's going to be fast moving. Yeah.
So have anything unusual happened? Anything synchronous happened?
Well, I don't know if it's synchronous, but I was very excited. So swimming out there, I love to run into seals. I really always want to go see seals when I'm swimming. Not everyone's favorite, but I really am eager to see them. But I'm not eager to see sea lions. So there's a little bit of like checking things out before you go. What kind of other neighbors are out in the water right now? And I went for a swim one time and there were some sea lions in the distance, not where I was going to be going, I thought. And so I went for it. And I'm swimming, but I also had seen a seal close to shore. So I'm excited. I'm like keeping my eyes peeled open, looking around whenever my head is underwater. I'm like looking as much as I can. And when I breathe, I'll like look for a little head. So I was very vigilant for these seals and swimming along. And lo and behold, below me, I see a sea lion sleeping, which I did not know that they slept underwater. I did a little bit of research because I was like, is this a thing? And in shallow waters, sea lions will sleep underneath the water. And it was just resting like on its lower, I would guess it was a female. It was a smaller, it wasn't a bull sea lion. It was resting kind of in like a gentle curve with its lower half resting on the bottom of the ocean, and its eyes were closed and it had its nostril flaps closed. And I was thrilled, but also freaked out because then I was like, I'm right over it. I'm afraid I'm going to wake it up. And I'm also like, I don't want to have any other sea lions come around, like if this one's here. So I immediately beelined over to my fellow swimmer, and there was a bull that surfaced, but they seemed to be a sleepy group in general. Like maybe they were sleeping at the surface and I hadn't noticed them, and this one was sleeping underneath. So the sea lions did not come over. There was no bad interaction. It was actually quite cool and gave me a little bit more of less trepidation about sea lions now. I'm still not eager to run into one, especially not a bull, but it was nice to have a positive experience and to learn something about them too that I had no idea.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I didn't realize that they would sleep under. But it was fairly shallow then, apparently.
Very shallow. Yep. So I could see the bottom. You know, I would say it was like 3 feet below me.
Oh, 3 feet below
you. So you could have dove down and like,
oh yeah,
rubbed its belly.
Yes.
Why didn't you? Give it scritches.
I was getting out of there as fast as I could.
You know, those sea lions, they come bug the snorkelers and everything. Yeah. And yeah, but you just got to go.
No big deal.
Shh, yeah. Scratch them on the belly.
I mean, gosh, it would have been amazing to touch it, but no.
That's too much.
I didn't want to bother it and have it wake up.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing encounter, I guess. I mean, I was like, is that an encounter? I guess it is. I mean, there wasn't an interaction per se, but just like this passing by. And,
yeah.
And they were gone when you came back, or you?
We took a slightly different route back, stayed closer to shore, just in case they were still a little out there. I didn't want to bump into them. So, I mean, the same route, but just a little closer to shore. Yeah. And didn't see them again. They didn't come check us out, didn't swim after us to see what we were doing. I don't know if the one down below woke up. So no further interaction, which was good. Yeah, it was quite exhilarating and scary and beautiful. And it was fun to look up about sea lions, like to learn something from an interaction and then to sort of doubt myself a little bit and be like, well, is that, do they even do that? Like, is that really what was going on? So then do a little bit of research to see what science has to say about it.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
That's pretty amazing. So I guess, you're swimming pretty close to shore. So like you, right. I guess you're like ready to bail if something, just go right to shore. Are you swimming with fins or just?
No, just a wetsuit to stay warm.
Yeah.
And then goggles.
So you're not exactly, creating a wake in the water.
Very slow.
Yeah.
You might wonder, is that person out there drowning?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've heard from folks that do that swimming, it's like, for example, and I actually experienced this once when I just was like treading water at Sage Beach one time, that the surface was much colder, and I realized, I guess at the time as I was thinking about it, that's the surface water, that's the fresh water coming out of the hatchery from the river, which was much colder than the ocean water I was there in late summer. I don't know, maybe that's true all year round, actually, because in the winter it would be colder.
I feel like you've talked about that.
So I've heard of people like doing the swim, like when they get around by Indian River, where the Indian River water comes out, there's like suddenly it gets really cold.
Right.
And, there is water, but much less volume that comes out there right at the Science Center from the hatchery. But
well, there's definitely, yes, absolutely notice that the water is colder right there when you start at Sage Beach because of the fresh water there. But also another interesting experience, which is that I wish I could remember what time of year it was. Maybe post-herring spawn. So kind of late spring and maybe even early summer. But a period where, we got used to the feeling very cold when we would first start. And then when you come back, you kind of come back through that cold water. But there was a swim that a group of us went on, and we all noted how the cold water was in a different spot, like not at Sage, not where the river outlet was, but like much further away, closer to this cone that we go to. So I have no explanation for it. I don't even have a theory. It's more just kind of like one of the beautiful things about doing something regularly that's not, like a big expedition, just going there, to the same place once a week and noticing these kinds of differences. I'm sure there could be a way to be, obviously could be very scientific about it, could try to find out what's going on, but I just observed, like, this was interesting phenomenon happened. I don't know why, and I don't remember it happening the next week even, like that same cold flow being in the same place. So a curiosity.
Well, there's this, I guess, somewhat famous saying. I don't even remember where it came from. Probably some like Buddhist or Zen thing or something, that you can't, or maybe it was from Europe, I don't know, but you can't step in the same river twice. Could have been Greek for all I know. Somebody some time long ago, you know, can't step in the same river twice. And that's, I'm reminded a little bit of that, because it's like, yeah, there's many of us who are sort of very inclined to go new places. I am not one of those people. I mean, I like going to new places, but I like going to new places that are within the pocket of places I've already been. So, you know, little gaps in the map that I haven't explored that are adjacent to places I've already been. When I do happen to travel more widely, I often feel, part of the reason I don't like to in the end is because I feel like I need to go back there again. And so each place that I go, it's like there's a little string that's like, oh, there's a little bit of a tug there. And so so I noticed that. But around here, where I've explored much more thoroughly than any other place, it is going, and it's always different. The forest is, you know, qualitatively similar, but when I go, especially going off trail or even on trail, it's like, oh, that tree fell over, that the tree didn't used to be knocked over, or, you know, things along those lines. And just, it's interesting. And just even thinking about kind of the human world, there was years ago, it was actually a little mushroom, you know, Kitty Labana used to do those mushroom workshops, and it was a thing out at, we'd gone out Mosquito Cove, and it was after that. And both Alice and Chuck Johnstone had been at that one, and Ryan Kaufman, all of whom have now passed away. And Ryan asked Alice, you know, about the changes that had happened in Sitka. I think Alice had moved here in like 1939 or something like that. And she just kind of paused for a second. Then she looked at me and she goes, why don't you ask him? And, you know, because I'd grown up here as well. And I said, well, the thing is, when you live here the whole time, like the changes accumulate and you kind of, like, you can be reminded, and if you think about it, you can start to think, but you're just, it's like, it's what is now that's kind of dominates for you. If you really want to know what it used to be like, ask somebody that moved away after high school, you know, from whatever era that you're interested in, because then it's sort of fixed in their mind like it was. And they'll come back and they'll go, oh, this used to be that and that used to be that. And, you know, those folks who had been there at the time can kind of remember that when you remind them, and they could probably, many of them, dredge it up. But yeah, it comes to be dominated. So it's this interesting pattern of sort of replacing. But when you have this experience like you're describing, where you're going and one time it's different and it's not the next, or, you know, mm-hmm. and then it's back to normal, mm-hmm. so to speak, then you go like, what is going on there? Mm-hmm. And then maybe the next time, maybe it happens again, and maybe you start to notice a pattern, or maybe it's a one-off. And
maybe,
yeah,
you don't journal. Maybe you make a note of
yeah.
it. Maybe,
yeah. And that's
then
where
there's like a little more to look at.
That's what the kind of the famous naturalist, basically, they were just doing that and keeping journals and noticing, looking for patterns or whatever, or noticing patterns over time. And I've done that a little bit. I'm not super strict about it. You know, the more sciencey you get, then the more strict and controlled you want to be and all those kind of things. But there's a lot of really interesting discoveries just from people being out and going, huh, that seems different. I don't know. But you don't notice what's different if you're not familiar with what's normal, so to speak. So that, like, even just finding rare birds, for example, I learned, and actually this, you know, people want to learn about species that live around here. My approach is basically look for things that don't look familiar. And at the beginning, most stuff doesn't look familiar. I mean, it kind of vaguely is like this, but start to like get to know specific, like, oh, spruce tree, hemlock tree, and then just be open to things that doesn't look quite right, you know? And as time, over time, as you're eye refines and your brain sort of starts to build the neural circuitry or whatever to recognize things, you'll start to notice more differences. When I was first learning birds, there were shorebirds that I literally didn't notice the difference. I told somebody, oh, there's this kind of shorebird down there, which I had seen. Turns out they were a different species of shorebird, which now to me look quite different, or distinctly different to me, I should say. They are similar, but they look distinctly different to me. But at the time, my brain just didn't see that difference. Mm-hmm. And the person I went with had a book with them and kind of carefully went through and said, oh, see these differences. And then over time, it just became automatic. I learned to recognize them in a way, but starting with just like what looks different. And then over time, your brain starts to develop the sort of ability to define a refined ability to distinguish things, I guess. And so you can go a long way just by saying, oh, what stands out is different today. And, you know, getting a picture using iNaturalist or whatever. Ever, just holding it as curiosity. So.
Well, one of the interesting things I think is like when you are first looking, you don't even know what to notice is different. Like the reason you probably thought the two birds look the same is that we tend to, or I feel like one way to describe it is you see more in like general swaths, where the more you get to know something, the more you're like, oh, but what color are the the legs? Oh, right. What color was the beak? And like at first, you're not seeing even that there's a beak or legs or whatever. Well, it's just kind of general.
Well, and I mean, Carrie, you did all that art class, right? One of the things that folks are often when they talk about drawing things is people draw what's the icon that's in their mind they're trying to draw, not what's actually there.
That's so for sure.
Yeah, we have this idea of what something is, and we're not really seeing what's there. We're just seeing bird, you know, whatever the label is somehow, and we don't realize it. But that's that process of asking the question and paying attention. And yeah, it won't be the first day or the second even, but over time, just by asking that question and revisiting it again and again, maybe drawing or maybe getting photos and comparing your photos and seeing, you know, what do these look different? But you know, I think probably all of us can safely distinguish a raven and an eagle and a robin, for example. So that's three that you're starting with. Well, it's not one of those. Is it small or is it big? You know, and so it's just, it can be very coarse categories, right? And then you just start to notice, and even if you're not identifying them or anything to begin with, you're just like, oh, that's one of those little brown birds. And so now you have a category that's little brown birds, as opposed to seagulls, as opposed to, you know, those black and white birds that are on the water floating around over there that always tend to tip over and go underwater, you know? So you just kind of make these kind of gross categories, not unlike you were describing, like there's functional categories that people would have had that were meaningful to them. You can start that way also if you're just interested in kind of getting to know it. We have amazing field guides and internet resources if you want to actually get into that. But if you're just like casual, I just enjoy this as something I'm doing while I'm going out. Plants is, you know, I've heard it described as the wall of green. It's just like, it's all green out there, right? But, you know, maybe you can recognize the difference between a tree and grass, for example.
Well, I am curious about your drawing class, Carrie, because you did look so specifically at all the parts of like a particular plant in your situation.
Well, this made me think of a question I had, and maybe you can help me remember the title of this book. It's about a girl who lives in the swamp.
Oh, yeah.
What's that book?
Oh, geez.
But it's... Okay, the girl lives in the swamp. She's basically been abandoned.
Crawdads, where the crawdads sing.
Yeah, where the crawdads sing. Highly popular. Mm-hmm. Not my favorite book, actually, but she lives in the swamp and she starts to draw. I don't know where she gets any materials because she's poor and there's no money. And she develops her talents. And suddenly, as a young adult, she is drawing illustrations for scientific journals. And I'm thinking, is that likely? Could that happen if she had neither formal training nor botanical training? Could she produce something that was a scientific illustration, or would it be more something, you know, an impression?
Generalized. Like
or misinterpreted scientifically, at least. Like, could she do that? I don't know the answer, but it's one thing I thought of when I read that book.
Well, I mean, you have more experience than I do with that kind of drawing, but just thinking about the sort of proclivities that people have, the sort of what seems like almost innate drive, talent sometimes, but often those folks that have remarkable skill spent a lot of time at it, even if they weren't formally trained. But if she's drawing what she's actually seeing, then... And so it's a true representation in sort of realistic detail.
If you think, though, about historically when people drew animals they hadn't seen before and how funky they were, and maybe sometimes they were drawing descriptions of people coming back. But I think techniques develop over years that people share with each other. Now, you know, to get into the story, perhaps she had books she could look at.
Yeah.
Perhaps she could just carefully observe and develop that talent. It's one thing that I was left thinking when reading that book. And it's not the library show, but I have something else I'm wondering about that book. But
yeah,
I do wonder. And not saying one is better. I'm not saying she would have failed to produce a scientific illustration, but is that what she would have produced?
I think the scientific illustrations, the scientific illustrations that I'm used to, and actually Paul's brother would be the person probably to ask about this, but my sense is that they are looking at many examples of something, and they're abstracting a little bit in a very realistic way the features of that are that thing. So they're not necessarily drawing an individual, although they might do that as well, I suppose, at times, but they're drawing, you know, looking at many leaves, and so this is sort of a captures the essence at some level of what a leaf of this plant looks like. But yeah, I don't know to what extent that could be developed just by somebody, you know, becoming excellent at drawing, or maybe they become excellent at being able to draw representational stuff. And then, you know, the actual stuff that you need to do the scientific illustration, like you're collaborating with somebody then and they're saying, oh, we need to see this. And so I imagine there's a back and forth between the illustrators and the scientists that are, you know, needing to see particular things. But was this a fictional book or was this?
Highly fictional.
So, fair enough. So I mean, who knows? It would be interesting to know if there, it wouldn't surprise me, let's put it that way, but I suspect it's not the norm, but that's just a guess on my part.
Yeah. Yes. So we're talking about illustration. I recently, during Whale Fest, had the opportunity to take Norm Campbell's scientific illustration. And I would say more it was an opportunity to for us to do some exercises around botanical or stones. But it did kind of get me excited again. And it was very social, which I enjoyed, but to take another class. So I'm thinking of either another botanical illustration class from a different institute or a marine illustration class. And the particular institute, Rhode Island Institute of Art, provides you with photographs. Mm. But I thought, there's locally somebody who has not East Coast photographs, but, you know, Paul Norwood.
Local.
And all that stuff down below that could be drawing.
Are you looking at, like, macroorganisms or microorganisms, both? Or?
I think macro.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it will be.
Because,
like,
I mean, it's kind of an interesting.
Clams and starfish and such.
But don't you have a recent interest in microorganisms?
Oh, yes. I don't know if I have time to talk about it.
Oh, we got time.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, armchair learning. But when I'm doom scrolling, I'm being fed two websites, two Facebook pages. One's called Amateur Microscopy, and the other's called Jams and Germs. And the first thing I saw was Jams and Germs, and their pictures of water bears walking were so detailed and lit and so much going on that I got fascinated in this kind of microscopy. And the guy, his name's James, and apparently he had some sort of mental health issues, or he was struggling in life and he looked at a drop of water and suddenly a whole world opened up to him. And, you know, I've always been a little interested. Everybody's the water bear craze, but suddenly I'm looking at rotifers. And part of this, I took a lot of science when I was younger, but it described a rotifer as a little animal. And I thought, do I even know what an animal is anymore? So I had to look up, like, what is an animal? And I had to, like, relearn in a very quick fashion what an animal was. But boy, the rotifers, and I know you have an interest in rotifers, or have had, or...
Yeah, well, my problem is that I'm a little bit, I have completionist tendencies, and drops of water tend to have a lot of stuff in them if you pick the water from the right place. So it has become a little bit of a challenge sometimes. It turns out, you know, for a long time when I was doing natural history stuff here, like in the beginning, I was like, okay, I'm interested in everything. You have to set some boundaries. There's only so much you could do. So I set geographical boundaries. I was interested in anything that's here that I can get a picture of that I could see without a microscope. Turns out some of the things you can see without a microscope require some microscopy to identify mosses and liverworts in particular. And so for years, I just kind of hoped somebody else would do the microscopy for me and identify the things. And I'd learned to, I figured most stuff I could learn to recognize in the field once I knew what it was. And I still think that's largely true, certainly to, like, genus. But there are some mosses and liverworts that you just would need to look at the microscope for, I think, unless you got really familiar with them. And then maybe you could, based on habitat and all these other sort of things that are difficult to describe or define well. But that'd be really getting to know them well, which would take probably more work than I'm going to put in. So I started, I guess 3 years ago now, I started getting a little more serious about doing microscopy, because I was like, well, if I want these identified, I guess I'm just going to have to do the microscopy. And it turns out I actually like getting photos. I like doing microscopy and getting photos. I do focus stacks, and I'm just as like ridiculous as my like Paul Race is, like he does so much stuff, but he doesn't do focus stacks. He's just like, oh, what's good enough, and we're moving on. And it's great for folks that can do that. I mean, then there's trade-offs. You know, you get a lot more volume. My pictures are going to look a lot nicer. And be more helpful for ID purposes in many cases, but also it takes me, you know, an hour to work with one collection essentially. And when I can easily pick up 30 collections on a hike, suddenly I'm looking at a lot of time at home with the microscope and then with my computer. And I don't mind that time. It's just like there's only so much time you can do in a day. So when I'm pulling these out, then yeah, sometimes there's rotifers living in the leaves, and then Paul also likes desmids, and he's like, oh, you should do desmids. They're pretty easy. And they are kind of easy, relatively speaking, but you know, I had other things going on this fall. I mean, in the summer, it's kind of the light season. I'm hiking, and so it's hard to make time. This time of year, I'm looking towards doing a little more work with the microscopes, with collections that are sitting in my refrigerator. But yeah, we find water bears and mites.
So I did as you said with the birds.
Yeah.
I realized, oh, I can't know all these things. So I kind of have a little idea about the water bears. So I'll add the rotifers.
Yeah.
But I keep seeing these mites and I recognize their mites. And then daphnids?
There's copepods, the kind of weird helmet-shaped things.
But I've also, right now, I'm not paying any attention to the microscopy because the site is also a place where they share techniques, advice.
Yeah.
They build their own microscopes. They share YouTubes. I'm ignoring that
you
part
can get
of it
really
for
into
now.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just learning what the little rotifers
are. And there's, I mean, there's little books of like pond life books or whatever that like broad groups give you a pretty good overview of the sorts of things that you might see.
Can I share something endearing, though?
So, please, yeah.
James, who has Jams and Germs, keeps his tardigrades. So he keeps them for years, and he names them. So there's like Garnet the tardigrade, Jake the tardigrade, Chopik the tardigrade.
How does he keep them, though?
I think on a slide or in a petri dish or something. So he must be providing it with little things to eat, because that's one thing I've learned under the microscope. All they're doing is eating each other. That's all that's happening, is they're eating each other. But he apparently gets quite attached, because when one of them passed on, he, you know, felt very sad and had a little bit of a, you know, crying episode over the death of one of the tardigrades.
Now, the tardigrades are indestructible, but they do die.
I don't know if they got eaten by something. Okay. I don't know. Or if, you know, it's him keeping it in an artificial environment, not like out in the pond. I don't know how the tardigrades have died.
I should say they're not indestructible. I've destructed them before. But they are remarkably resilient to drying out and freezing and radiation and any
number
of things.
So are the rotifers, so,
yes,
I learned.
Yes, actually rotifers are
as well. So recently they found a rotifer that was in the permafrost, I guess frozen, 24,000 years old, and they brought the little rotifer, who did not have a name, but brought it back.
And rotifers come in a remarkable variety of forms. They have these little spinny gear bits that you can kind of recognize, but then they're shaped. There's the ones that I most often see are like a tube that like the spinny bits come out and then they collapse back in and then they come out again. And it's kind of like this bag essentially. But then there's other kinds that I don't really, because I've mostly tried to focus on the it's hard to, they're moving also, which makes it more difficult to get decent pictures of, and I have such a backlog of photos, not just micro photos but macro photos, to get processed and uploaded, that I'm not probably going to try to learn to identify these things, even to groups.
No, I'm
going to just post them on iNaturalist and let other people tell me what they are. And over time, I'll learn to recognize them based on what I my photos and what people are calling them.
I think I can recognize one kind. It's called Deloid.
Yeah. Yeah. Deloid. It begins with a B, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
BD, Deloid.
I don't know why.
I have a question relating to the library show. These spinny bits.
Yeah.
The cilia at the top of the corona, at the top of the head of the rotifer. Sounds like some are just sitting there sort of wiggling and bringing food in. But in the deloids, it kind of, they've split off into two spinning right. bits, and they talk about them like they're really spinning. And that's my question. Are those things really spinning at
I
the top?
I think they are. They sure look
but
like
they
are.
But how do they spin?
I don't know.
What's the mechanics of something on top of your head spinning around?
Well, that's part of what's interesting around about them. You know, I think, was it Leeuwenhoek or whomever was,
it was the first
microscope
Could
guy?
Could you imagine looking through the microscope like, and for what, you're the first person to see
what
a germ,
is all this stuff?
A paramecium.
You're like aliens.
They are definitely aliens.
And then you're like, how does that work? I'm sure that probably the internet could tell us how these things spin. But I think they do spin. And one of the ways that they capture food is by creating little vortex whirlpools that essentially bring
it also
in.
Is what moves them.
Yeah.
That spinning will propel them.
Yeah. So it is.
They're not like the tardigrades with.
Trundling. Yeah. Trundling seems like the word for tardigrades. They kind of do their little thing.
But it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's like. I don't know names and but different habitats you'll find different things, you know, bog puddles versus freshwater, you know, Swan Lake.
Oh, I went to
ocean.
Watch a video about the rotifers thinking I was going to get the overview, and it was a British presenter, 15-minute video. All he did is talk about sex for the first 10 minutes. I thought, what are we getting to rotifers? I don't understand this. But and I didn't quite finish, but I did get to the point where I understood why he was talking about sex.
Rotifer for, sex?
All sex.
What?
Rabbit sex, rotifer sex. Okay. So he was making the case that asexual reproduction is maybe a more advantageous way to reproduce and laying out the case, because a lot of rotifers reproduce asexually. They can also reproduce sexually. And then the poor little male rotifers are just little vestigial creatures that have no digestive system. They just are born ready. They do their function.
And then that's it.
They die.
Well, there's fish. There's a male. Is it angler fish?
Angler fish.
Yeah, where the male basically just gets embedded in the female,
yes,
and absorbed into her. Yeah. Yeah, there's all sorts of weirdness in the animal. Well, I shouldn't say the animal world specifically. The world.
One thing, you know, I did most of my studying 40 years ago, and one thing I find is like nowadays it's just so much harder because so much genetic information
right.
is out there, and then reclassification. That you know, it's like I need a re-education to even like do some of the learning I want to do. Like
yeah.
rotifer sex. I need a re-education if I'm to understand that.
Well, it's interesting. That's one of the things that, I mean, you've the last science course that I took, specifically a science course, I was in high school.
Yeah.
And so I did math and statistics in college and graduate school, and I am just interested and, you know, vague understanding of DNA. You know, I wouldn't say it's super strong. I just accept, you know, I'm not looking to study it critically and be able to evaluate. I'm willing to trust people.
I find, though, to read some articles anymore, you have to have an understanding of genetics, and it's like, dang, I don't.
So a lot of that statistics stuff, so I understand more of the statistics stuff without necessarily understanding the genetics. When they're talking about trees and Bayesian classifications and all that, that's all statistics. So I have a sense of that. But in the end, what I care about is the results. And
yeah.
it's like, okay, what does this mean for what I call things? And, you know, everybody can be interested in different aspects of it. And because I'm primarily focused on natural history, I'm just interested in what's going on here. Again, there's more in the world than I will ever be able to take in or know. So I don't begrudge myself, you know, saying that's far enough on that particular rabbit hole. But it's interesting to talk with people. And that's one of the reasons I like doing this show, is just talking with people who have deeper, different interests and sort of that intersection and the questions and things that emerge from that sort of discussion are fascinating. But yeah, it can be easy, unless you're interested, to get overwhelmed with like mushrooms, for example. But the nice thing with mushrooms is you can send them in and get the DNA analysis done, and they'll give you a, you know,
tell you exactly.
The genetics say that it is. And sometimes, you know, in many cases, that can be undescribed species that somebody will eventually perhaps describe. And they're, you know, they're asking different questions than some of us are asking just as natural history people, but there's an intersection there that can be fruitful and interesting to explore. But for me, I think I like to think of what I'm doing and what I'm most interested in is getting to know the neighbors, right? I was reflecting on this. I was on the Whale Fest cruise the other day, and it's kind of a staple of whale watching cruises and things like that, that there's just the rundown of the physical facts, right? And it amused me to think the other day, well, so if I was introducing somebody to one of my neighbors, well, this is my neighbor, 6'5", 220.
Oh, let's not do that math.
Right. So it's like, those aren't the kinds of facts, right? That, I mean, we do that with the natural world all the time. Right. And that's what many people expect. But, and that's why it amused me, because absolutely we wouldn't do that with our human neighbors, right? That
if
would
we
be
want
really
them
weird.
To remain
yeah.
congenial with
right.
us.
So it was kind of funny to think about it in those terms, but then also reflecting back, okay, so what does that mean? You know, maybe I do that, but what am I sharing? If I am getting to know the neighbors and then I'm sharing that with other people, what does that mean? And it's like telling stories or you know, things that are a lot more relational, I guess, oriented and kind of this is, you know, what I've observed. And it's less about, you know, statistics, I guess. And I don't mean like statistical analysis, but I mean like facts and figures of sort of populations or whatever. But it's more about, you know, how I relate to them in the world, how I understand them to relate to the world around them and those sorts of things. And so
we are all neighbors. And I like to think that
that's true.
When I see a little round bird, which is the level I see it, that I can always ask Brooke, like, I saw this thing and it did this thing. Do you have any ideas? And you always do.
Or Matt.
But
even better.
I mean, clearly you're the bird expert in the neighborhood, so I know who to ask now when I see a bird. I don't know what it is.
She knows the neighborhood birds.
Yeah.
Well, that goes back to maybe where some of this conversation started, which is just like being aware of your neighbors, where your place that you are. You don't have to go on some big expedition. You can stay in your house sometimes and dissect a plant and
look out the window.
Look out the window. I do that so much. Notice the time season changing with the birds that come to the feeder.
And see the bird that darts from underneath the porch to underneath the car.
Oh, that's probably a song sparrow.
Song sparrow.
Yeah. See, that's what I mean. Yeah. I just have to ask the question.
Could be a wren, but probably a song sparrow.
No, it's a song sparrow. I do hear them there.
Yeah.
I can recognize the sound of them, but I don't know, have a fix on what they look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is funny because, you know, I know Brooke, you're a gardener, part of garden group. And as I have commented more than once in recent weeks, I've never met a gardener that said, oh, I'm all caught up. Okay. So it's like gardening is this forever thing that gets you out. And I say that because I basically ignore my yard. Like I put in some plants some years ago and it's just like, all right.
Good enough.
I step through my yard to go somewhere else because I'm afraid, like, if I spend time in my yard, I'd be like, oh, I should do this or that or the other, and I don't want to get sucked into that vortex, I guess. Mm-hmm. But there's a sense of sort of loss there where I am like, I honestly don't really know what's going on in my yard a lot of times. And, you know, there's a bird feeders that my son has set up, and so we watch those sometimes. My daughter noticed a white, she goes, are white-throated sparrows like the crown sparrows? And, you know, that's like, she's actually pretty good at recognizing birds, but she doesn't keep their names all straight. And she'll notice if something's different to the point. And over the years, I've been like, if you see something that looks different, I trust you. If it looks different to you, then tell me about it because it's probably interesting.
Brooke, do you mainly know all the birds you encounter
in the yard?
Or out kayaking or as you're preparing to swim, do you know the birds?
I wouldn't. I mean, I know the birds. Like when I go swimming, I can identify them, sure, but I don't know. No, I don't know all the birds when I go out into the world. I mean, I'm often with Paul when I'm hiking and doing things like that, and so that's very helpful because he knows the birds more than I do, so I can ask him if there's something that we see that I don't know. Yeah, but I know many.
Yeah.
And is that something that you have known for a long time or that you just sort of set out intentionally to learn or you just kind of absorbed over time?
Just by going out kayaking a lot or hiking a lot.
Or being in your garden.
Or being in my garden, right? Getting, you know, periods of time where you get curious.
I keep seeing that bird. I wonder what it is. Yeah.
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 Asking and, friends and neighbors, too.
Yeah.
Like, and, this guy is visiting our yard. What do you think? What is that?
Yeah. In my view, that's like the best way to do it. Just be like out there and observing. And I happen to take that a little farther than a lot of people because I'm weird that way. But yeah, it just like... Just paying attention in your yard, and you never know if you're willing to guess. Like, you can get into the beetles and be like, "Oh, I haven't seen that kind of beetle before," or insects. And as a gardener, you know, sometimes that can be useful information to know because some of them impact plants for better and worse.
It's actually an interesting topic in our garden groups at different times, for sure. Where we'll be like, "Did you see?" Someone will pull a beetle out of the soil and like, "Oh, is this the blank? And is this eating my blah or whatever? Oh, someone take a picture of this for when Kitty is back." And you know, or admiring different worm lengths and sizes, or so like the definitely is a big deal. Those little critters often having to do with like, what are they doing in my soil? What are they doing to my plants? But
so
we're very curious.
Beetles live in the ground.
There will be beetles that will, you know, kind of come crawling out from.
It kind of explains a childhood experience where I stuck my finger in the dirt and something bit me as a child and
for
it felt insectoid.
Yeah.
It felt like it was that size, but I didn't know that beetles lived down
and
there.
And think of grubs, all sorts of stuff.
It was very
soil.
Shocking.
I mean, they're ground beetles, those big kind of long-legged black beetles. There's some that kind of have an almost maroon kind of abdomen color. They're snail eating. They'll eat slugs and snails, but they have kind of aggressive pinchers, and they'll be, they like in rotting wood or whatever. So
this was in Iowa.
Yeah. So who knows what was in Iowa? You got more insects there. But yeah, we're getting to the end of our time here. Not too far off. Is there anything else you'd like to mention, Carrie?
I don't think so, other than you two can have a water bear and give it a name.
Pet water bear, the care, the uptake is probably cheap, but probably does require attention regularly. Yeah.
Yes, and this guy's giving them attention.
Yeah, well, more power to him, I say.
Yes, and he's amazing photographs, or not videos, of the water bears seen from below walking across slides. And he says that at first they don't know how to walk on the slide, so they're very awkward, but then they figure it out.
I wish everyone could see Carrie's interpretation of them walking once they figured it out. It's a little jaunty, a little bit of a dance. It's pretty awesome.
Brooke, do you have anything else?
I don't think so either. I'm pro... If you can take care of them and you need a cheap pet, water bear sounds pretty cute. I think you probably need a microscope to really enjoy it.
Yeah, that'd be the expense, actually. The upfront expense of a microscope would probably be the challenge.
At some point, I'm going to jump into the whole microscope world.
Cool.
But it seems very complicated.
Well, yeah, it depends on what you want to do with it.
I have a dissecting one.
Oh, yeah. So a compound microscope is, it's not that complicated to get, like, you know, a 10, 20, 40X kind of compound scope.
They go to 300X.
Oh, some of them
somehow.
Do. Yeah, and there's some really, well, the main objective, and then the eyepiece is usually another 10X or something. So, but
that's the discussions they have. And some of them have scanning electron microscopes.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And some people just do it with their phones. So it's all the tools.
So it kind of depends on what, that's a whole other thing that, like, some people get as much into the equipment as they do the what the equipment is used for. So I am much more like, well, I would probably in the end like microscopes that I could get better photos with, but they're good enough and I can work with them. And, you know, if money becomes no object at some point in the magical future, maybe I would then do a little more research now that I have this experience. But yeah, to begin with, it's often not, especially if you don't know how much you're actually going to put into it, getting something that's not super expensive and is functional and that you can see stuff with. But you have friends that have microscopes. Paul's, you could stop by Paul and Brooks,
come
I imagine.
Over before
and,
for some
what kind of microscopes
he's
does
got
he have?
Three different kinds.
Oh,
so,
I'll have to come by and see.
Yeah, he definitely has compound scopes because I see the pictures that he posts on, and he'll just put his cell phone up to the eyepiece to get the pictures.
I did that in the botanical illustration in class, and it worked really well for what I was taking photographs of. But it felt magical.
Yeah.
Felt like I'm putting it over here and then it came out a beautiful photograph in itself.
Yeah. There's something, I don't know, there's just some experience of seeing the thing through the microscope that there's a little bit of magic involved. It's like, wow, this thing is there. And knowing at some level, like, you can see the slide and you can't see anything in the slide, and then you can see through it. You're like, wow, it's
part of what they're doing too. Is some of it's just for the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Clearly some people are making art by taking pictures of like very small things.
Mm. Well, yeah, we should wrap up here. I appreciate all your enthusiasm. Hopefully some folks are inspired to maybe not swim for a kilometer in the ocean, or maybe they will, but to pay attention in their yards and at the beaches and in the microscopes of their drops of water, however they want. Yeah, appreciate y'all taking some time to visit with me.
Thanks, Matt. That was fun.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Carrie Sagal and Brooke Schaefer of The Library Show. Perhaps you caught me as a guest on their show earlier today. If not, you can find that on kcaw.org for the next week. Look at the program schedule, and the latest shows are available there. I look forward to coming back in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, if you see anything out there that's interesting, I'd love to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.